Tibetan Sage by Tuesday Lobsang Rampa, read for you by Blue Friend in beautiful BC. Chapter 4. The Lama Mingyar Dondup looked exceedingly pleased, and he was even more pleased when I pointed out maps of several other caves. I had been rummaging around on a shelf and marveling that there was not a speck of dust anywhere, and the, well, I would call it paper, but actually it was some substance like paper, only very, very much finer. Our paper was all handmade stuff from papyri, but I picked up this pile of paper and saw that they were maps and charts. First, there was a very small-scale map showing an area of about 250 miles, and then the tunnel was marked out with certain breaks in the line to show where it was no longer passable, and one would have to get out of our own tunnel and look for the entrance to the other one. It was shown on the map, all right, but how many earthquakes had made the map inaccurate? That was the problem. But then, the next map was a chart of the cave in which we were now ensconced. It showed all the rooms, and I was amazed at the number of rooms. And the cupboards and rooms were all labeled out, but, of course, I couldn't read any of it. My guide could, though. We laid the map on the floor and laid down on our tummies while we looked at it. "Lobsang," said the Lama, "you have made some remarkable discoveries on this trip, and it is going to count very heavily in your favor. I brought a young Chela here once, and he was quite afraid to even enter the cave. You see, the old hermit who fell to his death was actually the keeper of the entrance, and now we shall have to build a fresh hermitage to guard the entrance." "I think we hardly need a guardian, sir," I said, "because the whole of the tunnel through which we entered is blocked, apparently through the earthquake, shaking a whole sheet of rock, and that slipped down to cover this entrance. Were it not for these maps, we could be stuck here forever." The Lama nodded gravely and got to his feet and walked along beside the shelves looking at the books, reading their titles. Then, with an exclamation of delight, he pounced on one book. Oh, it was a massive thing, a great big fat book, looking as though it had just been made. "A dictionary," Lobsang, "of the four languages used. Now we are well on the way." He picked the book up and again brought it to the floor. It needed the floor to take all the charts. The tables would have been too small. But the Lama went rustling through the pages of the dictionary and then, making notes on the chart of our particular cave, he said, "Centuries and centuries ago, there was a very high civilization, far higher than the world has reached since. But, unfortunately, there were more earthquakes and sea quakes, and some lands sank beneath the waves, and according to this dictionary, Atlantis is not just one sunken continent. There was one in the sea which they called Atlantic, and there was another one lower down in the Atlantic. It was a place where there were many high peaks, and those high peaks still protrude above the waters, and now they're called islands. I can show you on the map just where it is." He rustled around among the papers and then produced a great big colored sheet of paper. Then he pointed out the seas and the places where Atlantis had been. Then he continued, "Atlantis, the lost land, that is the real meaning of the word. It is not a name like Tibet or India. It's a generic term for the lost land, the land which sank without a trace." We maintained silence while we looked at those charts again. I was anxious to know how to get out of the place. The Lama was anxious to find certain rooms. At last he straightened up and said, "There, Lobsang, there, in that room, there are wonderful machines which show us the past and right up to the present, and there's a machine which shows the probable future. You see, with astrology, for example, you can foretell what's going to happen to a country. But when it comes to foretelling one particular person, well, that takes the genius of an astrologer. And you had such a genius astrologer forecast your future, and it is quite a hard future indeed. Let us explore some of the other rooms first, because we want to spend a long time in the machine room, where the machines can show us what happened since the first people came to this world. In this world, they have many peculiar beliefs, but we know the truth because we've been able to tap into the Akashic Record and the Akashic Record of probabilities. That is, we can foretell accurately what will happen to Tibet, what will happen to China, and what will happen to India. But for the individual, no. The record of probabilities is very much probability, and not to be taken too seriously. "Master," I said, "I am absolutely confused, because all the things I have learned have taught me that there is dissolution. Paper should crumble to dust. Bodies should crumble to dust. And food after a million years, well, that certainly should have crumbled to dust. And I just cannot understand how this place can be a million or so years old. Everything looks new, looks fresh, and I just cannot understand it." The Lama smiled at me and he said, "But a million years ago, there was a much higher science than there is today, and they had a system whereby time itself could be stopped. Time is a purely artificial thing, and is used only on this world. If you are waiting for something very nice, then it seems an awful long time that you have to wait for it. But if you have to go to a senior lama to have a good telling off, well, it seems no time before you are in front of him, listening to his opinion of you. Time is an artificial thing, so that people can engage in commerce or in everyday matters. These caves are isolated from the world. They have what I call a screen around them. And that screen places them in a different dimension, the fourth dimension, where things do not decay. We're going to have a meal before we explore further, and the meal will be of a dinosaur, which was killed by hunters 2 or 3 million years ago, and you will find it tastes quite good. But, Master, I thought we were forbidden to eat meat. Yes, the ordinary persons are forbidden to eat meat. It's considered quite adequate that they live on Sampa, because if one gorges oneself on meat, then one's brains get clogged. We are having meat because we want the extra strength which meat alone can give, and anyway, we have very little meat. Mostly we have vegetables and fruits. But you may rest assured that eating this meat will not harm your immortal soul. With that, he got up and went into the kitchen store, and he came out with a big container which had a most horrible picture wrapped around it. It showed what I imagined had to be a dinosaur, and outlined in red was a marking showing what part of the dinosaur was in the canister. The llama did some things to the canister, and it came open. I could see that the meat inside was absolutely fresh. It might have been killed that day, it was so fresh. We are going to cook this because cooked meat is much better than the raw stuff, so you'd better watch what I do. He did some queer things with some of the metal dishes. Then he tipped the contents of the canister into one of those metal dishes and slid it into what looked like a metal cabinet. Then he shut the door and turned some knobs so that little lights came on. He said, "Now, in 10 minutes, that will be perfectly cooked, because it is not cooked on the flame, but it is heated from the inside to the outside. It is some system of rays which I do not profess to understand, but now we must look about for some suitable vegetables which will go well with the meat." "But however did you learn all this, Master?" I asked. "Well, I have traveled quite extensively, and I have picked up knowledge from the Western world, and I see how they prepare a special meal on the 7th day of the week. I must confess that it tastes really good, but it needs vegetables, and I think we have them here." He put his hands deep into a closet and pulled out a long canister. He put it on the workshelf and carefully studied the label, and then he said, "Yes, here are the vegetables, and we have to put them in the oven for 5 minutes cooking." At that instant, one light went out. "Ah," said the llama, "that's a signal. We must push these vegetables in now." So saying, he went to the oven thing, opened the door, and slid in the complete canister, and then he quickly shut the door. Then he adjusted some knobs on the top, and a different light came on. "When all these lights go off," Lob sang, "our meal will be perfectly prepared. So now we have to get plates and those other fearsome implements that you saw, sharp knives and metal things with little bowls at the end, and those other things which have 4 or 5 spikes at the end. They're called forks. I think you are going to enjoy this meal." Just as he finished speaking, The little lights flickered, dimmed, and were extinguished. "There you are," Lob sang. "Now we can sit on the floor and have a good meal." He moved forward to the hot place, which he had called an oven, and carefully he slid aside the door. The smell was beautiful, and I watched with the keenest anticipation as he took the metal dishes off the shelves. He ladled out a good portion of everything for me, and then not so much for himself. "Start in," Lob sang, "start in. We've got to keep your strength up, you know." There were dishes, different colored vegetables, none of which I had ever seen before, and then this bigger dish with a big lump of dinosaur meat on it. Cautiously, I held the meat with my fingers until the llama told me to use a fork to hold the meat and showed me how. Well, I cut off a piece of the meat, looked at it, smelt it, and put it in my mouth. Quickly, I rushed to the sink in the kitchen, and I got rid of the meat in my mouth. The llama was roaring with laughter. "You're quite wrong in your thoughts," Lob sang. "You think I'm playing a trick on you, but I am not. In some parts of Siberia, the local people sometimes dig up a dinosaur which has been caught in the permafrost and frozen so solid that it might take 3 or 4 days to thaw. They eat dinosaur meat with the greatest of pleasure." "Well, they can have my share of this with even greater pleasure for me. I thought I was poisoned. What vile stuff is this? I would just as soon eat my grandmother than that muck." Carefully, I scraped the last remnants of the meat from my plate, and then, looking dubiously at the vegetables, I thought I would try some. To my astonishment, they tasted very, very good indeed. Mind you, I had never tasted vegetables before. All I had ever had to eat before this occasion was sampa and water to drink. So now I had a goodly helping of everything until the llama said, "You'd better stop," Lob sang. "You've had a really big meal. You know, you're not used to these vegetables. This first time, they may keep you on the run, and then they'll go through you like a purge, and I'll give you a couple of tablets which will calm your disturbed stomach." I swallowed the wretched tablets, and they seemed as big as pebbles. After I had swallowed the things, the llama looked at me and said, "Swallow them like that, eh? The usual way is to wash them down with a good drink of water. Have a go at it now. Fill up your cup with water and wash away the powdery taste." Once again I got to my feet and went into the kitchen. Tottered into the kitchen would be a better explanation, because never in my life, having had vegetables or fruit, well, I could feel alarming churnings inside me, so alarming, in fact, that I had to put down my cup and run all the way to that little room at the hole in the floor. A couple more feet, and I should have been too late. However, fortunately, I reached that hole just in time. I returned to the llama and said, "There are many things really puzzling me, and I just cannot get them out of my mind. For example, sir, You say this place might be 2 million years of age, then how is it that the vegetables and the fruits are quite palatable? Look, Lobsang, responded the Lama, you must remember that this world is millions of years of age, and there have been many, many different types of people here. For example, about 2 million years ago, there was a species of creature on the earth, and they were known as Homo habilis. They came into our era by inventing the first tools of this particular cycle. You see, Homo sapiens is what we are, and we are derived from that other Homo, which I have just told you about. To try to make you understand a bit more, let me say that the world is like a garden, and all the buildings in the world are plants. Well, every so often the farmer will come along and he will plow his garden. That means that he will turn up the soil, and in so doing he will upset all the plants and the roots. They will be exposed to the air for a few minutes, and then as the plow comes over again, they will be buried more deeply, so that in the end no one could tell that there had ever been such and such a plant in that garden. It is the same with humans on this world. Think of us as the plants, but the humans of different types are tried out, and if they cannot manage to the satisfaction of the gardeners, then catastrophes and disasters will be their lot. There will be mighty explosions and earthquakes, and every trace of humanity will be buried deep beneath the soil, and then a fresh race of people will appear. And so the cycle will go on, just as the farmer ploughs under the plants, so the gardeners of the world cause such disasters that every trace of the habitations is shattered. Every so often a farmer will be busy with his patch of ground, and then he might spot something sparkling in the ground where he was digging. And so he will bend over and pick it up, wondering what it is, and perhaps he will tuck it in the front of his robe to take home and show his wife, and perhaps to his neighbors. He might have dug up something which was buried 1 million or so years ago, and now, with earthquakes, that piece of brilliant metal will have been brought to the surface once again. Sometimes a piece of bone will be discovered, and the farmer will spend perhaps a couple of minutes wondering what sort of creature it came from, because there have been some very queer creatures on this earth. There have been women, for instance, with a purple skin and 8 breasts aside, just like a pregnant bitch. I suppose it would be quite useful to have the 16 breasts, but that race died out because it was impractical. If the woman had given birth to a lot of children, her breasts would have become so pendulous that she would hardly be able to walk without falling over, so that race died out. And then there was another race whose men were about 4 feet tall, none taller than that, and they were born horsemen, not like you who can hardly sit on the tamest pony we've got. But these were extremely bow-legged, and they had no need for stirrups or a saddle or anything like that. Their natural body conformity seemed to have been designed especially for horse riding. Unfortunately, the horse hadn't been invented at that time. "But, sir," I said, "I cannot understand how we can be in a mountain, right inside a mountain, and yet we have good, brilliant sunlight and plenty of heat. It baffles me, and I cannot think of any solution." The Lama smiled, as he often smiled at some of my statements, and he said, "These rocks, which we call mountains, have special properties. They can absorb sunlight, and absorb it, and then, if one knows how, we can get the sunlight released to any degree of brightness that we need, as the sun is shining more or less all the time on the top of the mountains. Well, we are always storing up sunlight for when the sun has gone about her journey and is beyond our vision. It is not at all a magical thing. It's a perfectly ordinary natural occurrence, like the tides and the sea. Oh, I forgot, you have never seen the sea. But the sea is a vast body of water. It's not drinkable, because it comes from fresh water, which has run down a mountainside and across the earth, bringing with it all sorts of impurities and poisonous subjects. And if we tried to drink the water, it would hasten our death. So we have to use some of the stored sunlight. It falls on a special sort of plate, and then a cold draft of air plays on the other side of the plate. Then the light manifests itself as heat on one side and cold on the other. The result of that is that droplets of water form, born of the light from the sun and from the cold of the earth. That will be absolutely pure water, called distilled water, and so we can catch it in containers, and then we have plenty of fresh drinking water." "But, Master, this business of having things a million or 2 million years old, well, I just cannot understand it at all. The water, for instance. We turned a metal thing and we got cold water, which obviously had been put in a tank somewhere a million or so years ago. Well, how hasn't it evaporated? How can it possibly be drinkable after all these years? It's got me absolutely defeated. I know, on the Patella roof, the water tank would soon dry up, and so how can this be a million years old?" "Lobsang, Lobsang, you think we have a good science now. You think we know a lot about medicine and science, but to the outside world, even we are just a bunch of uneducated savages. Yet we understand things that the rest of the world does not. The rest of the world is a materialistic group of people. This water might be a million or 2 or 3 million years old in years, but until we came here and broke the seal and set everything working, well, it might have just been an hour or two before. You see, there is such a thing as suspended animation. We've heard a lot from other countries about people who have gone into a cataleptic trance for months, and there is one now which is already past the year and a half mark, and the person looks none the worse for wear. She looks no older. It's just, well, she is alive. We can't feel a heartbeat. We can't get any breath on a mirror. So what is keeping her asleep? And why is it not doing her harm? There are so many things to be rediscovered. All these things were commonplace in the days when the gardeners came. Purely, as an example, let me show you the room. Here it is on the chart. Look. Where bodies were kept in a suspended life stage. Once a year, two lamas would go and enter that room, and one by one, they would take the bodies out of stone coffins and then examine the bodies carefully for any ills. If everything was all right, they would walk the bodies up and down to make their muscles work again. Then, after they had fed the bodies a bit, would come the task of putting the astral body of a gardener in the body taken from a stone coffin. It is a most peculiar experience. What, sir? Is it really a difficult thing to do? Now look at you, love saying, telling me, on the one hand, that you can't believe such a thing, and on the other hand, you're trying to find as much information as you can. Yes, it is a dreadful feeling. In the astral, you are free to be whatever size is most convenient to be. You might want to be very small for some reason, or you might want to be very tall and broad for some other reason. Well, you pick the right body and then you lay down beside it, and the lamas would inject a substance in the apparently dead body, and gently they would lift you and put you face down on that body. Gradually, over a period of 5 minutes or so, you would disappear. You would get fainter and fainter, and then all of a sudden, the figure in the stone coffin would give a jerk and sit upright and make some sort of explanation. Oh, where am I? How did I get here? For a time, you see, they have the memory of the last person to use that body, but within a matter of 12 hours the body would have taken the appearance to be absolutely normal, and would, indeed, be capable of all the things that you could do if you were on Earth in your own body. We do this because sometimes we cannot afford to risk damaging the real body. These simulacrum bodies, well, it doesn't matter what happens to them. They've only got to find someone with the right conditions about them, and then we could put the body in a stone coffin and let the life force drift away to another plane of existence. People were never forced into it, you know. It was always with their full knowledge and consent. Later on, you will inhabit one of these bodies for a year, less a day. The day is because the bodies would only last 365 days without having certain intricate things happen to it. So it is better to have the takeover to last a year less 1 day. And then, well, the body which you are still occupying would get into the stone coffin, shuddering at the coldness of it, and gradually your astral form would emerge from the substitute body and would enter your own body and take over all its functions, all its thoughts, and all its knowledge. And on that now would be superimposed all the knowledge that you had gained during the past 364 days. Atlantis used to be a great exponent of this system. They had a great number of these bodies which were constantly being taken over by some super person who wanted to get a certain bit of experience. Then, having got the experience, they would come back and claim their own body and leave the substitute for the next person. Oh, but Master, I am honestly puzzled indeed by this, because if a gardener of the world has all these powers, then why cannot he just look east or west or south or north and see what's going on? Why all of this rigmarole of occupying a substitute body? Lobsang, you are being dim. We can't afford to have the real high personage damaged. We cannot have his body damaged, so we provide him with a substitute body. And if an arm or a leg be taken off, that's just too bad. But it does not hurt the high entity who took over the body. Let me tell it to you like this. Inside one's head there is a brain. Now that brain is blind, deaf, and dumb. It can only go about animalistic procedures, and it has no real knowledge of what it feels like. For an illustration, let us say that the very high entity so-and-so wanted to experience what it was like to be burned. Well, in his own body, he would not be able to get down to the rough, crude vibrations necessary for one to feel the burn. But in this lower entity body, yes, burns can be felt. So the super entity enters the substitute body, and then the necessary conditions occur, and perhaps the super entity can get to know what it is like through the experience of its substitute. The body can see, the brain cannot. The body can hear, the brain cannot. The body can experience love, hatred, and all those sorts of emotions, but the super entity cannot. So it has to get the knowledge by proxy. Then all these bodies are all alive and ready to be used if anyone comes along? I asked. No, 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 far from that. You cannot enter the entity into the body if it's for the wrong purpose. The super entity must have an absolutely authentic good reason for wanting to take over a body. It cannot be done from his sexual interests or his money interests, because they do not help in the advancement of anyone on the world. It usually happens that there is some task being done by the gardeners of the world. It is a difficult task because, being super brains, they can't feel things, they can't see things, and so they make arrangements for an appropriate number of them, the super brains, to take over a body and come down to Earth and pose as Earthlings. I always say that the biggest trouble is the awful smell with these bodies. They smell like hot, rotting meat, and it might take 1/2 day before one can overcome the nausea occasioned by such a takeover. So there really is no way in which a super entity who possibly has gone wrong somewhere can victimize the substitute body. It can watch what others are doing, obviously, but nothing can be done which will harm the super entity. Well, all this is a terrific puzzle for me, because if a super entity is going to wait until a body is perhaps 30 years of age, what is going to happen about the silver cord? It's obvious that the silver cord is not just cut off, or I suppose the body in waiting would just decay. No, no, Lobsang, the Lampa replied. These substitute bodies have a form of silver cord which leads to a source of energy which keeps the way open for the body to be occupied. This is known in most religions of the world. The silver cord is by metaphysical means connected to a central source, and the people who look after these bodies can assess their condition through the silver cord, and they can add nourishment or take away nourishment depending on the condition of the body. I shook my head, baffled, and said, "Well, how is it that some people have the silver cord emerging from the top of the head, while others have it emerging from the umbilicus? Does it mean that one is better than the other? Does it mean that the belly button exit for the cord is for those not so evolved?" No, no, not at all. It doesn't matter in the slightest where the silver cord emerges. If you were of a certain type, you could have a silver cord emerging from, say, your big toe, as long as the contact is made. That is all that matters. And as long as the contact is made and kept in good order, the body lives on in a state of what we call stasis. That means that everything is still. The body organs are functioning at their very, very slowest, and throughout the whole of a year, a body will consume less than one bowl of sampa. You see, we have to do it that way, or else we should be forever traipsing along these mountain tunnels, making sure that a body is being properly looked after. And if we had people come here to feed the bodies, then it would actually do harm to the body, because a person could live under stasis for several million years, provided that it has the necessary attention. And that necessary attention can, and is, given by way of the silver cord. Well, then can a great entity come down and have a look to see what sort of body the super one is going to occupy? No, said the Lama. If the entity who is going to take over a body saw the body unoccupied, he wouldn't dream of entering such an ugly-looking thing. Look, come with me, and we will go into the Hall of Coffins. So saying, he picked up his books and his staff, and rose to his feet rather shakily. "I think we should look at your legs first, you know, because you appear to be in considerable pain." Lobsang, "No, let's have a look at these coffins first, and then I promise you we will do my legs." Together we walked along fairly slowly, the lama consulting his chart every so often, and then at last he said, "Ah, we take the next turning left, and the next turning left again, and there is the door which we must enter." We trudged up on the path and turned to the left and took the first turning left again, and then there was the door, a great door, looking as though made of beaten gold. As we approached, a light outside the door flickered on, and then steadied into a constant light, and the door swung open. We went inside, and I stopped a moment, taking in the rather gruesome sight. It was a wonderfully appointed room, with a lot of posts and rails. "This is for a newly awakened body to hang on to, Lobsang," said the lama. "Most times they are a bit giddy when they are awakened, and it is a rather nuisance to have one, just awakened, fall flat on his face and mar his features so much that he cannot be used for some time. It upsets all one's arrangements, and then perhaps we have to get a different body and a different entity, and that makes a lot of extra work. None of us appreciate that in the slightest. But come over here and look at this body." Reluctantly, I went over to where the lama beckoned. I wasn't fond of seeing dead bodies. It made me wonder why humans had such a short lifespan. Short indeed when you know of a tree which is about 4,000 years old. I looked into the stone coffin, and there was a nude man. On his body he had a number of, well, it looked like needles with thin wires coming from them. And as I watched every so often, the body would give a twitch and a little jump. A most eerie sight indeed. As I watched, he opened sightless eyes and closed them again. The lama Mingyar Dandap said, "We must leave this room now, because this man is going to be occupied very, very soon, and it is disturbing for all of them if there are intrusions about." He turned and walked out of the room. I gave a last look around, and then I followed quite reluctantly, because the people in the stone coffins, men and women, were quite nude, and I wondered what a woman would be doing occupying one of these bodies. "I am picking up your thoughts, Lobsang," said the lama. "Why shouldn't a woman be used for some things? You must have a woman because there are some places where men cannot enter, just as there are certain places where women cannot enter. But let us move a little more quickly, because we do not want to delay the waiting super-entity." We moved a bit more quickly, and then the lama said, "You seem to have quite a lot of questions. You know, why not ask them, because you are going to be a super lama, and you have to learn an incredible amount, things which are taught to about only one in a million of the priesthood. Well, I said, when the superentity has entered the guest body, what happens then? Does he rush out to get a jolly good meal? I'm sure I would. The Lama laughed and replied, no, he doesn't rush anywhere. He's not hungry because the substitute body has been kept fed and well nourished, ready for immediate occupancy. I can't see the point of it, though, Master. I mean, a super entity. One would think he would enter a body which has just been born, instead of all this messing about with dead bodies which are like zombies. Love saying, just think for yourself. A baby has several years before it learns a thing, and it has to go to a school. It has to be subject to parental discipline, and that's a real time waster. It wastes perhaps 30 or 40 years. Whereas, if the body can do all that and then come to these coffins, then indeed he is worth much more. He knows all the conditions of life in his own part of the world, and he doesn't have to spend years waiting and learning and not being at all sure of what it's all about. I have had such experiences already, and things that have happened to me, well, they don't seem to have any sense in them, I said. Possibly I shall get some enlightenment before we leave this place. And anyhow, why is it that humans have such a terribly short lifespan? We read about some of the sages, the really wise people, and they seem to have lived 100 or 200 or 300 years, and they still look young. Well, Lob sang, it's just as well to tell you now. I am over 400 years of age, and I can tell you exactly why humans have such a terribly short life. Several million years ago, when this globe was in its infancy, a planet came very close and almost hit this world. In fact, it was driven out of its orbit because of the anti-magnetic impulses from the other world. But the other planet did collide with a small planet which it shattered into pieces, which are now known as the asteroid belt. We shall deal with that more extensively a bit later on. For the present, let me tell you that when this world was in formation, there were tremendous volcanoes all over the place, and they were pouring out gouts of lava and smoke. Now the smoke rose up and formed heavy clouds all around the earth. This world was not meant to be a sunshine world at all. You see, sunlight is poisonous. Sunlight has deadly rays which are very harmful to a human being. Well, the rays are harmful to all creatures, but the cloud cover made the world like a greenhouse. All the good rays could come through, but the bad rays were shut out. And people used to live for hundreds of years. But when the rogue planet came so close, it swept away all the clouds covering this earth, and in a space of 2 generations, people had a lifespan of 70. In other words, 70 years. The other planet, when it collided and destroyed the smaller world to form the asteroid belt, spilled its seas onto this world. Now we have water forming our seas. But this other world had a very different sort of sea. It was a petroleum sea. And without that collision, this world would have had no petroleum products, and that would have been a very good thing, because nowadays drugs are taken from petroleum, and many of the drugs are harmful things indeed. But there it is, we just have to live with it. In those early days, all the seas were contaminated with the petroleum products. But in time, that petroleum sank down through the seas and through the seabeds, and it was collected in great rock basins, which were the result of volcanic influences under the seabed. In time, the petroleum will be quite exhausted, because the type of petroleum available now is of a type harmful to man. Its combustion causes a lethal gas to be formed. That causes many, many deaths, and it also causes pregnant women to produce sickly children, and even in some cases, monsters. We shall see some of these very shortly, because there are other chambers we're going to visit. You will be able to see all of this in third dimensional stage. Now, I know you are bursting to find out how photographs could be taken a billion years ago. The answer is that there are tremendous civilizations in this universe, and in those days they had photographic equipment which could penetrate the deepest fog or the darkest darkness, and so photographs were taken. Then, after a time, the super science people came to this earth, and they saw people dying like flies. And one could say, because if people can only live until 70 years of age, that is very short indeed, and does not give one the opportunity to learn as much as one should. I listened with rapt attention. I found all this utterly fascinating, and in my opinion, the Lama Mingyur Dandup was the cleverest man in Tibet. The Lama said, "We, here, on the surface of the earth, know only half the world, because this world is hollow, as many worlds are, as the moon is. And there are people living inside. Now, some people deny that the earth is hollow, but I know it is from personal experience, because I have been there. One of the biggest difficulties is that scientists all over the world deny the existence of anything which they did not discover. They say it's not possible for people to live inside the earth. They say it is not possible for a person to live several hundred years. And they say it is not possible that the cloud coverage, when swept away, caused the lifespan to shorten. But it is actually so. Scientists, you see, always go by textbooks which convey information which is about 100 years old by the time it reaches the classrooms, and places like this. This cavern, where we are now, were put here specially by the wisest men who lived. The gardeners of the earth could get ill just the same as the native humans, and sometimes an operation was necessary, an operation which could not be performed on earth. So the sufferer was put into a state of suspended animation and sealed up in a plastic case. Then the medical men in the caves would send special etheric messages for a hospital spaceship, and the hospital spaceship would come quickly and take away the containers with the people who were ill in sealed inside. Then they could either be operated upon in space or taken back to their home-based world. You see, it is easy to travel at a speed much in excess of light. Some people used to say, "Oh, if you travel at 30 miles an hour, it will kill you because the air pressure would blow out your lungs." And then, when that was proved false, people would say, "Oh, man will never travel at 60 miles an hour, it'll kill him." And then, the next statement was that people would never travel at a speed faster than the speed of sound. And now, they are saying, nothing can ever travel faster than light. Light has a speed, you know, Lobsang. It is composed of the vibrations which, emanating from some object, has its impact upon the human eyes, and the human eyes see what the object is. But quite definitely, within just a few years, people will be traveling at many times the speed of light, as do the visitors here in their special spaceships. The ship outside in the other chamber that was just getting ready to take off when the mountain quaked and sealed their exit, and of course immediately that happened, all the air in that chamber was exhausted automatically, and the people aboard were in a state of suspended animation. But they had been in suspended animation so long that if we tried to revive them now, they would probably be quite insane. That is because certain highly sensitive portions of their brains would have been deprived of oxygen. And without oxygen, they die. And the person who has such a dead brain, well, they're not worth keeping alive. They are no longer human. But I'm talking too much, Lobsang. Let's go and look at some of the other rooms. "Master, I would like to see your leg first, because we have here the means of healing it quickly, and it seems wrong to me that you should suffer when, through this super science, you can be cured very, very quickly." "All right, then, Lobsang, my budding doctor, let us go back to the place of health, and we will have a look at my leg and see what we can do." End of chapter 4.